You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 164 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Value of Thinking for a Cognition that Satisfies the Human Being. I might have said it was 12 lectures before. It is, in fact, 11 lectures, translated by Christian von Arnim. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on the 19th of September, 1915. Yesterday we led our considerations from a certain perspective to the characteristics of imaginative cognition and attached importance to emphasizing that the human being has in themselves everything they consciously bring to consciousness through imaginative cognition. I use the comparison that in a darkened room there are various objects, also people, if you like, that cannot be seen with physical eyes in a dark room. Then you enter with a light and everything inside is illuminated. There is nothing new in it. Everything was there before. The only difference is that things are seen and perceived afterward and not before. It is the same with what imaginative cognition presents to us. Everything which imaginative cognition brings to consciousness is present in the human being, holds sway, and works in the human being down below in the hidden depths of the soul. It is part of what lives and weaves in the human being. And what is especially important for the human being on the physical plane is that they are continually enhanced or diminished in their forces in some way or other by what in life they assimilate, experience, and let sink down from their conceptual life into the depths of consciousness. I will have something more to tell you about this matter in greater detail on a later occasion, because the process is very incompletely characterized when we say, here, and there's a drawing, is the threshold of consciousness. Here is a conception that sinks down into the subconscious and is now down there like a living being. As I said, the process is described rather incompletely. But it is our intention only slowly and gradually to ascend to the true facts in this area. What I want to say today, then, is that we become aware of how these facts of imaginative cognition are, of course, as you can see from what has been discussed, thoroughly and deeply connected with all the conditions of life of the human being, also on the physical plane from birth to death. But they belong to the unconscious or subconscious conditions of life, so that we can gain from what we have considered also the important truth that the human being, as they live on earth, is dependent on conditions that do not enter into the clear daytime consciousness that we have from birth to death, except when we are asleep. So we are dependent on life factors that cannot be known with the ordinary normal consciousness. But in the whole way in which I have presented it, these factors of life which hold sway down there, and we said yesterday, in the etheric body, are still quite close to the human being. So close that, because they are related, they connect with that which the human being continually lets sink down from their conceptual world. For the human being can, as it were, if they transform their thoughts into recollections, themselves transform their thoughts into the substance that is down there in the subconscious. After all, it is substantially wholly the same as what we think. When what we think is down below, it is just such a churning, squirming world of mice as that which lives and weaves down there and which is basically living thought life. But that is the etheric body that has come into the etheric body from the cosmos. And because it is related to our conscious thought life, it is still very close to the human being. And as it lives and weaves, today in us in the unconscious, so it was basically fully present during the old moon existence. The moon thinking, if you imagine it as dreamlike, if you think of it as being completely immersed in the dream life, was just like when you dream, but perceive in the dream the living weaving of thought. that gives you the conceptualizing on the old moon. The only thing that there is in addition during our existence on Earth is that we have to make an effort to have thoughts, to form thoughts through our own efforts. The inhabitant of the old moon did not form these thoughts through their own effort. They lived in dream images, the only difference being that they were not as dead as our thoughts, but were actually weaving life, image-weaving life. You can see from what I have presented to you that when we enter into the imaginative world, we gain something and lose something at the same time. The calmness, the earthly calm experience of thoughts, that is what we lose. We no longer have control over that because the thoughts themselves are living inner powers. In ordinary life, we feel that we are the rulers over our thoughts. We don't have them in that way there in the imaginative world, but in return, we also take hold of a life that is simply life. The thoughts we have in physical life are dead. What we grasp there, that lives and weaves. And that is what it was already like during the old moon existence for human beings, only they had it dreamlike and not consciously. Then there was the ascent to consciousness in Earth evolution, and from the conscious cognition of that which was dreamlike during the old moon existence, imaginative cognition emerges as the first stage of that from which spiritual scientific cognition must be taken. So this imaginative cognition is still very much related to the human being. Now, I said you gain something and you lose something. People would readily agree with the former, the gaining of something, but they don't agree with losing something. And that is the source of countless errors. It is the source of very, very many errors. You see, it is not so very easy, if we do not make an effort to imagine what actually this dreamlike, imaginative conceptualizing was like during the moon period. When we live here on Earth, it is inconvenient, because of the physical period of development, to always have to form ideas and thoughts on the basis of earthly facts. That is precisely what is inconvenient about studying. We must really consider the facts, judge the facts, relate the facts to one another. And we must slowly, through our own efforts, work our way through the worlds of thought and ideas which we as earthly human beings control with our earthly will. Some then find it much more convenient if the living world of thoughts is simply given to them in such a way that they only have to wait for it. If they get, in quotes, enlightenment from it, then it goes into their soul life, then they no longer need to develop thoughts. That is what they think. But that doesn't get them any further than they are. We stand much higher as Earth human beings than as Moon human beings because we have continued to develop. Compared with the dreamlike imagining of the Moon, as Earth human beings who combine the facts and who, with our rational judgment, form concepts from the experiences of life, we stand much higher than the Moon human beings and those who long for the return of this Moon existence, which consists of enlightenment, not thoughts that have been worked on. We can have peculiar experiences in that respect. Not that the human being, when they sink back to this moon cognition, has no thoughts. They do have thoughts. But the latter come of their own accord. The person does not need to do the work of thinking in facts. That again seems quite convenient. We can repeatedly have a specific experience, a very important specific experience, which must be considered if we want to understand these things properly at all. There are people who come to have a certain visionary clairvoyance. This dream-like imagining, this visionary clairvoyance, is always a falling back into moon nature. For the real clairvoyance, which we want for the Earth, must be based on a higher level, on an even greater elaboration through the world of thought, than the cognition of the physical plane. Sinking back is not an elevation, not an ascending development of the human being, but a descending development, becoming less intelligent than we are as normal human beings. And that is where this particular experience occurs, which we can have over and over again. There are people who have a certain visionary clairvoyance, but are not actually intelligent at all. Indeed, their clairvoyance is connected with the fact that they flee intelligence, that they do not like to develop the intelligence that we have to develop as a human being on earth. It is precisely this dulling of the ordinary earthly intelligence which is very often associated with a certain degree of visionary clairvoyance, which is a moon-like, atavistic one. And then perhaps the following occurs. Such people can then make a record of their pictures. These records are not thoughtless, but interwoven with thoughts. The thoughts come with the images, and intellectually brilliant. Very brilliant images are interwoven in them. And then the riddle can arise. Yes, here is a person who describes in images, in very beautiful images, Atlantis, or also other things that come to them in a visionary way, and that is absolutely logically intelligent. I have never perceived such intelligent logic in that person, when they have to explain something about the things of the physical plane. Then they don't have it. They have not become enough of an earthly human being. But when they are allowed to fall back into the moon intelligence, then the intelligence comes. But then it is not their intelligence. Then they are merely a medium for the moon intelligence. Then the moon intelligence works into them. We can get wonderful descriptions of spiritual worlds from people who have sunk back a little into the moon stage, and who, when they want to use their earthly acquired intelligence, cannot understand themselves, what they have actually produced, and usually do not even want to. I said, in ascending to imaginative cognition, you have to gain something and lose something, and that most of the time people don't want to lose anything. I also pointed out that there are people who have intellect and do not want to lose it. Now, these are not the ones who love visionary clairvoyance because they quite like to lose ordinary intelligence, ordinary thinking. But there is another group that does not want to lose this intelligence. They want to preserve this intelligence as it is on the physical plane, only they do not want to develop it further. They do not want to continue working in relation to this intelligence in order for the human being to come to use concepts more freely than they are used under the processes of the physical plane. And then such people get into allegorizing, into symbolizing, which after all is only an activity of the physical plane, because it does not continue to develop the thinking, but leaves it standing and then wraps fine words around it of all kinds of exquisite occult things. That is very important that this is also taken into account. And you see, this was already in the awareness of those who slowly and gradually worked their way up or wanted to work their way up to the points of view that we must have today in spiritual science. Today in spiritual science, we really must bring something of clear thinking to humanity, combined with the possibility of knowing something of spiritual worlds, but in the clear, in completely clear thinking. It really took a long time for the possibility to arrive, and hopefully it is now here, to penetrate these matters in this way. And many people have worked their way through to this stage. After all, people of such great clarity as Goethe, for example, have come very close to complete clarity. But many have worked their way through to this stage. Just think how Jacob Burma struggled at the point of transition to the materialistic age, to work his way out of the chaotically writhing, moving, whirling, and teeming concepts, which he already had, in such a way that something emerged which he presents as a profound illumination of some of the secrets of the spiritual world. Someone else again uttered some wonderful words, let me say, as if wonderfully illuminating the horizon at the dawn of the modern age, from which we can see, or at least you can see it from the other things he achieved, how although he was not able to penetrate with a completely clear view to what should be spiritual science today, he was nevertheless able to get as far as presenting its most important nerve. for the man I am now talking about realized in the 18th century. If you want to understand the human being, you must penetrate through the darkness, through the confusion of external material cognition. This is necessary even if you are at the first stage of imaginative cognition. For we have seen that what weaves down there in the depths of the soul cannot be reached at all with physical cognition. We have to penetrate the darkness. But that's not the only thing we have to do. We must also penetrate through the confusions of ordinary concepts to cognition. We must also dispel these confusions. So we must also get beyond the ordinary thinking that works on the physical plane. And in this situation, this man then coined a very beautiful phrase. The first part of this sentence is happily followed. The second part is almost never followed. But it is important to follow it. You see, this is what most people admit today, who somehow want to become or be mystics in some field, that one must cast off the sensory, the material, that one must cast off the muddles of the material in order to penetrate the spiritual. But few admit that one must also cast off the forms of the spiritual that cling to thinking in concepts, for they would like to take them with them, would like to make use of them, just as they do on the physical plane, would like to find the thought down there in the subconscious as a possible memory in just the same form as it has up here. But it would be a mistake if you were to believe that the clairvoyant, when they look into the human mind, finds the thoughts there exactly as the person thinks them who has them in his head. That is not true. Down there they are transformed. They are living beings, an elemental world. The world of thoughts that the human being has here on the physical plane is not found in the spiritual world. That is why that man coined a beautiful sentence that I want to write down for you, because it can really be seen as a kind of trial in our own mind. How do we come to know anything about the worlds that lie outside the earthly world? He said, and Steiner writes on the blackboard, readers aside, my apologies for this. This is in French, I believe. I cannot read French, but I'm going to attempt this. End of readers aside. Disipez vos ténèbres matérielles et vous trouverez l'homme. With this part of the sentence, dispelling the material darkness and confusion, people who want to be mystics agree. The second part of the sentence, however, people still barely understand today. Again, Steiner writes on the blackboard, quote, disipez vos ténèbres spirituelles et vous trouverez Dieu, close quote, whereby for Dieu, because it is still colored by religious ideas, we have to imagine the whole content of spiritual science. You see, he could not yet find the expression that we can find today. Now, you can surely imagine that when someone reads the sentence today, disipez vos ténèbres matérielles et vous trouverez l'homme, that they say, yes, fine, that's how I enter the spiritual world, that's what I want. But in disipez vos ténèbres spirituelles et vous trouverez Dieu, they will say, but what will be left for me since I will no longer have anything? Indeed, what is left? Precisely this remains. What today is the content of spiritual science? This is necessary. The cognitive content of the physical plane, usually believed to be the only correct one, must be dispelled, just as the material darkness must be dispelled. Now take note how this is observed in our spiritual science, bracket, there is a gap in the transcript, close bracket. These words come from the so-called philosophe inconnu, Saint Martin, who considered himself a pupil of Jacob Burma. Thus we find in Saint Martin already a deep longing for that which is to come to light in spiritual science. But he calls himself philosophe inconnu, unknown philosopher, because what he carried within himself, even though, of course, the people who saw him saw his nose, saw his hands, heard the words he spoke, remained foreign to them. The actual philosopher, Saint Martin, remained unknown to them, quite unknown. So it is the acquisition of imaginative knowledge, in accordance with the discussions we had yesterday, a return, a conscious return, to the way the human being related to the world during the moon period. So that we can say, you will recall we have already presented this from another side in lectures here in particular, events still prevail in human beings today. But in a supersensory way, as something spiritual and supersensory, which are actually not normal events on earth, but were normal events during the moon period. They have preserved these moon events. They can regress in a certain sense. Then they produce cognitions in a completely different way than the earthly human being can produce such cognitions. They can come to visionary clairvoyance, have dulled intelligence, and pose precisely the riddle of which I spoke earlier, namely, that if they were induced to work in a sensible, scientific way, or even to make sensible decisions with regard to the most ordinary everyday events, they cannot do it, that they would not succeed. But when they write something from out of their vision, even about the events that took place at the time of the mystery of Golgotha, they only write down images, remain in the moon life, but nevertheless write something terribly clever. And what they write doesn't match up at all with what is otherwise known about the person. So theoretically they can't do anything, but as a medium they write very clever things, so that we can be amazed at the cleverness. But that is not a forward development. That is a regression of the human being. This, of course, does not exclude the possibility of truths coming to light through such a person, because they in turn stand in earthly existence and are connected with earthly existence, and in addition have this still active moon life in them. I've tried to depict the different types of human beings in the mystery dramas, and also to draw such a figure that reverts to the moon-like, that is, who is unintelligent on the physical plane and yet can reveal correct things. In other words, who stands below the level of the normal earthly human being. That is Theodora. Theodora is a figure who is specifically meant to be a reversion to moon consciousness. That is very clear, after all. I mean to say that it is very clearly indicated there how it is, in that it is said in the one place where Theodora appears, Theodora a seeress. In her, the will element is transformed into naive seership. That is what naive seership means, moon seership. Naturally. It is naive seership, and that is how the character is rendered. And it is for this reason that in the final mystery, Theodora herself can no longer appear, but only her soul, because she cannot participate in certain things. These mystery dramas in particular should be viewed very, very precisely. Perhaps the time will come when some of you will be able to understand that hardly anything has happened here in the last few days that could not already be read about in some form in the mysteries. Had it been read as things should be read, these confusions would not have been necessary. So to be clear, that which is experienced as the imaginative world is still relatively very close to the human being. Much less close to it, on the other hand, is that which can be experienced as the inspired world. For when we first live our way into the inspired world, it embraces those facts which did not take place during the moon existence, but already during the old sun existence, and which the human being has also preserved. So we penetrate into even greater depths of the human soul when we work our way through to the inspired world, and the inspired world that we initially encounter now has a certain distinctiveness. You see, when the human being works their way through to the imaginative world, they come across facts that took place during the old moon existence. If you imagine the old moon in the phases where it was split off from the sun of that time, you can read about this in title Occult Science. The human being lived at certain times on this moon that was split off from the sun. And what the human being experienced there is what we first encounter when we return with the old dreamlike imaginative clairvoyance. But when we enter the inspired world, we do not experience, in the return, an existence split off from the sun, but an existence directly within the sun. That is, the facts that the human being experienced together with the sun. We really do experience real sun facts. And these sun facts, you see, they are now actually no longer related to the human being. For as the human being is now, during Earth existence, if they don't look into the depths of their soul, don't look at what is in the deeply hidden grounds of their soul, they are actually more of a shell through what they are on Earth. They are not a real human entity. They are more of a shell. To begin with, they have their physical form. It was created during our existence on Earth in the way it appears to us on the physical plane. But forces are at work within it that cannot be seen, and which even present science has not yet sought. It was suggested to a friend of ours to look in this direction with the biological material at his disposal. This friend is making a lot of effort, and perhaps after some time, such things require a lot of study, he will be able to publish something to create a possible bridge over to these hidden parts of human nature. But it is necessary to investigate precisely those biological facts which are not taken into account by present science, which the present researcher, who is experimenting, leaves to one side, as it were. So we have to investigate the preparations for what the other researchers are not interested in at all, what they leave to one side. There is still a lot missing, of course, and a lot of new research needs to be done. It is easily possible that this will be the work of many years until it can be finished. But it would be immensely important work because it could show us what is still attainable by the means of physical science regarding what lives in human nature from the old moon. A whole new embryology, a new part, a new side of embryology will result. It is necessary that this gets done at some point, but that is actually the end of it. That's all we can find when we look at the human being externally. For what can be found in the human being today, externally, is actually no older, not even as old as the oldest time of the old moon existence. But from such research to which I've just referred, it will be possible to draw conclusions about processes of the old moon existence. They will agree with what is described in title Occult Science. But as I said, we don't get very far back if we look at the human being as they are today, not even to the beginning of the old moon existence, let alone to the old sun existence. If we want to return to the old sun existence, then we must take much, much less of the material nature of the human being than can be taken in the science which I have just referred to. For what is involved here is that something actually penetrates into human nature, which the human being on Earth can bring to revelation, but does not have to bring to revelation. They can, but they do not have to bring it to revelation. When, for example, inspiration really comes to the artist, to the poet, then ultimately, if it is really inspiration, it comes from the spiritual world of sun existence. It really comes from the spiritual world of sun existence. But our time is so terribly poor in spirit that what comes from the inspiration of sun existence is rejected. And people really only want to create naturalistically, to stick to the model, that is, to the earthly. Whereas what can come from the model is only the material for what we are actually supposed to create. The arts that protect the individual artist from clinging to the model, from succumbing to the material, are architecture and music. Basically, architecture cannot replicate anything, and often does so quite clumsily, too. And music can't imitate anything either, because it is not really music if you imitate bird calls and cat's meows in the way that you copy models in painting and so on. In music, you can only take the very elevated material of the tone. But that's how it should be in every art. As much as the musician takes from the music, the painter must take just as much. What the tones are for the musician, the form, the color, must be for the painter. The model should not give them more than the material. So the artistic cannot be taken from out of the model, but springs from the inspiration that leads back to the old sun existence. That is why the truly great works of art are so foreign to the earth. I said that the human being can live without artistic inspiration. They can introduce it. They don't have to introduce it. The Aimora might well say, the human being can also live without art. Readers aside, there is a word here, A-I-M-O-R-E with a grave over the top. Aimora, not sure what that means, end of readers aside. But now you can, and those who are involved in these things in a deeper sense will do so, sooner or later, you can raise a fundamentally important question. The question, so if you have Saturn existence, Sun existence, Moon existence, Earth existence, all with certain facts, and return to Moon existence in imaginative cognition, to Sun existence in inspired cognition, then from this it follows indeed that we return to Saturn existence in intuitive cognition. So if that is the case, that we have no new facts, but return to the old facts. Why does the human being need to evolve at all? So someone might raise this question. Why evolution? Why then the whole existence on earth, which detaches us from the facts through which we have developed, so that the cognitions are moved down into the unconscious, and we must first cognitively climb back to them again? Why all this? You see, because only through this can we become true human beings. Because only through this can we really complete our true nature. And this can also be seen externally if we really study such personalities who had something of these mobile concepts, of this conceptual mouse, as I have mentioned to you, for example, in the Metamorphosis of Plants and the Metamorphosis of Animals by Goethe. We have to study such characters. And such characters show at the same time that if they are inwardly completely true, they stand in a quite specific relationship to a still different world of the soul. This is particularly evident in Goethe. Study title Wilhelm Meister. Study all Goethe's poems. And you will find that in a strange way, a certain manner of judging the world, of passing judgment on the world, occurred in him. For you will find, if you engage yourself in these things, that to the same extent that the metamorphosis idea develops in Goethe, a really genuine, magnificent inner tolerance of soul also develops in him. A wonderful tolerance in the soul develops in him, a remarkable way of relating to the world and to life, a tolerance of the soul. And this is connected with very deep facts. You see, when we look at the animal world, this animal world has the most diverse forms. If, for example, we compare the hyena, which bears its desire for carrion in its face, which bears its species in its whole posture, with the lion, with the wolf, and if we again compare these animals with the eagle, and the eagle with the vulture, then compare these animals with turtles, snakes, worms, the various insects, if we take all these different animal forms, we must surely ask ourselves, how is this connected with the spiritual world? Now you can only study that if you study the old moon existence. Because why? You see, during the old moon existence, the human being did not yet exist in their present form. The corresponding forms that were present at the human stage were the angels. With the angeloi, the angels, there existed quite different forms of judgment, quite a different way of thinking than we have today. The angels were then on the same level as human beings are today, but they were not in such a physical body as human beings are today on earth. They were in a very soft, supple body, for the spirits of form had not yet collaborated to form a solid shape for bodies. Now at that time, that is not now during the earth period, but during the moon period, these angeloi thought in concepts which, compared with our earth concepts, were much more filled with life. But these concepts have something very distinctive in addition to their vitality. They were highly saturated with impulses of mind. Stirred up under the influence of the archangeloi, the archai, the spirits of form, the spirits of movement, and so on, the angels conceived the concepts during the moon period. but they were living impulsive concepts, much more impulsive than we find concepts in people today, who alternately become either happy bunnies or furious bunnies, in quotes, don't they? When they put their emotions into how they judge life. There are such people, and they can be the best of people, but they will alternately be delighted, inclined to be delighted about something. They will be happy bunnies, or else they will be distinctly furious bunnies, so that their whole life lies in what they utter, and everything comes out in the concepts, doesn't it? Well, that was present to a much higher degree, directly creative, with these angels on the moon. Let us imagine a moon dweller thinking in this way. He will say to himself, well, I must now form a concept. Inspiration tells me, a wretch whose back rises from the rear to the front, who pulls a repulsive face out of a longing for carrion. This creature arises as a result, is condemned to be a hyena. Here we have the creative concept. The forms of the animal kingdom are intimately connected with this creative thinking, which creates according to the principle of good and evil. And the whole animal kingdom in its various forms is such a configuration of good and evil. The human beings of the earth were not meant to learn this. One who did not want to relinquish the moon culture seduced human beings into recognizing good and evil in the form that he experienced it during the moon period. He, bracket, there is a gap in the transcript, close bracket, made judgments in that way. But human beings were to learn to make judgments differently. Such strong insertion of emotions into concepts should not go down into the deeper depths of the soul. That had to be discarded. That had to give way to a more objective, a more calm form. That is why the human being had to progress from moon to earth evolution. And if they now continue to advance, they will become even more tolerant. Such a moon angel, well, they hated the hyena in an unbelievable way because it was evil for them. They hated the snake, hated what was ugly, and loved what was beautiful. Good and evil belong to the realm of creative life. The human being had to get out of this habit. Human beings could not develop earthly science if they were to divide animals, as the moon angels did, into beautiful and ugly ones. We divide differently, according to objective concepts, don't we? Into seemly and unseemly animals, into mischievous and cunning animals, and so on. The moon angels had all that. But it would not be scientific today, for example, if it were written in a learned book, The Weasel, characteristic, cunning. This may be done in a satirical poem, but in science today it must be pushed away. It can't be like that today. Thus, in order to make progress in this field, we must be able to rise to a level at which we view those things against which human beings have the most violent emotions in earthly life as scientifically as the animal kingdom is viewed scientifically without emotions today. And this is what we can see in the particular nature of Goethe's spirit. For him, human life is a calm stream to a much higher degree, which he views like natural phenomena. That is exactly the wonderful inner serenity of Goethe's view of life. That for him a part of human life also enters into the stream of natural facts. This enabled him to become so objective. Well, starting from this point, we will have to take up the matter again and continue these reflections tomorrow. The end of Lecture 3.